Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Truth of Happiness Dhamma study, Sangha discussion on the concentration factors of the Eightfold Path, and Dhamma talk that introduces the seventh week study of the three marks of existence. This was recorded on January 28, 2017, at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace.
So last week's study, for those of you that are going through the course, I know Brett, you weren't here, and I'm not sure if Kevin is following along. Last week's study was on the concentration factors of the Eightfold Path, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. Right effort is the reminder and the guidance that we need to put some time in developing a meditation practice. And also that we need to develop that meditation practice within the broader framework of the Eightfold Path. Right mindfulness is a reminder of what that actually means. As far as mindfulness relates to the Buddhist teachings, it's to be mindful of the four foundations of mindfulness that we use primarily in meditation, and also to be mindful of each factor of the Eightfold Path. So, of course, we have to first learn what those factors are and then gradually integrate them as part of our practice and part of our life. And then right meditation is simply the meditation method that the Buddha taught for 45 years of his teaching career, which is what we do, shamatha, vipassana, meditation. But also to understand, part of right meditation is understanding that meditation is a supportive factor of the other seven factors of the Eightfold Path, meaning it's not something that we practice separately. So start with Becky. How was your study last week? Nice to see you this morning.
Nice to see you too. I felt like I just was concentrating in my mind on right effort. And I just, as I noticed that this just happened as I went through my days, the idea of not that I really was able to practice right speech, but I was just thinking a lot about what it meant. So it was a week where I felt like the teachings that I'm learning in here came into my mind often, and I would find myself just thinking about them. You know, what does that really mean? And I felt that was good. That was a way for me to internalize that initially. You know, like, this is the first step.
Yeah.
And I did meditate more last week than I have meditated in the past.
Yeah.
So I was able to, you know, make time for that. While thinking about the teachings, one of the things that I was confused about how I can learn to not want to prepare for something that might happen in the future.
Good question.
And I recognized that that's not something that that his teaching does not espouse that. It's not something that I sort of should be doing. Anyway, I felt like it was very hard for me not to want to prepare. And I said that. I was talking about that with my husband, and I said, you know, what I'm learning is all about being in the present and having my mind concentrated and feeling like my mind is ready to deal, to just be in the present, really. And I said, but what I'm having trouble with is I keep thinking about how do I prepare for something that might happen in the future. And he said, which I thought was really good, he said, well, maybe the idea is to just train your mind so that you will be ready for whatever happens.
<That's it. laughs> I said, tell him he can teach next week's class.
Next week's class.
I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, that was. I think I've taken enough time.
Boy, that's exactly how. First of all, you're describing the skillful beginnings of right effort. And so the first thing we do is we start gaining an intellectual understanding of what we should be thinking about, and now you're thinking about it. And that brings the ability to recognize what needs to be changed. Now, as far as preparing for what might come, preparing for the future, there's nothing in the teachings that said, don't do that. In fact, your husband's response was really it. So we train our minds and our view of the world so that we are prepared for anything that comes. And it doesn't mean that we shouldn't do the mundane things that are necessary for tomorrow to occur peacefully, meaning if you want to pay the rent, you probably got to go to work, you know, if you want food on it. And that it's too easy, and the ego loves to jump on this. Well, if in the part of the later teachings talk about nothingness and emptiness. If there's no such thing as a self and everything is empty, well, why should I do anything? And of course, that contradicts everything the Buddha taught. He taught the Eightfold Path as a middle way between extreme views, and one of those extreme views would be, well, there's nothing to do. And the other extreme view is that I should be completely engaged in a sensory way with everything that occurs. Meaning I should just give in to every one of my desires. Both extreme views. The middle way shows us that life is going to occur, and the First Noble Truth states that dukkha is going to be a part of that, and unsatisfactory, disappointing occurrences will arise in life. If we can get to the point, and the Eightfold Path takes us there, where we don't want anything to be different than it is as it occurs, then we can remain at peace and respond with wisdom. And that response from a wise point of view is then laying the foundation for what will occur in the next moment and for the rest of our lives. So the greatest preparation we can do for what's next is to take to the Dhamma and awaken, gain full human maturity. Along the way, it's a good idea to take care of ourselves physically, emotionally, mentally. I'll use the word loosely, spiritually. It's a good idea to do the things that we need to maintain shelter for ourselves. The Buddha said there's four things that we need to be concerned about: food, shelter, medicine, and a realistic place to practice the Dhamma. He didn't say don't worry about any of those things. Well, he didn't say, he probably would say don't worry about them, but take a mindful attitude towards what's necessary to live a human life. He was not teaching a way for us to escape life or escape our bodies or develop some mystical way of living. He taught the most practical way of living in the world, and a way of living in the world that we are free of self-induced stress, self-induced drama, self-induced conditions that lead to simply more distraction. So that was a brilliant answer by your husband, and a great observation. Thank you. Jen, so we're discussing you've been here.
The
concentration factors.
Yeah. Well, I'm really enjoying going through this a second time. And I'm feeling a lot more spaciousness and peace and just happiness going through my day, focus. So I thank you for that, and I thank everybody for that. Mm-hmm. I was having a conversation with Lorna last week. She was talking about aversion and the sensation underneath aversion, how she said you were recognizing that you were avoiding something,
yeah,
but you didn't know kind of what it was, and that resonated with me because I was the week before thinking or kind of playing around with recognizing that when I am stressed or worried or thinking a lot about things that I recognize are irrelevant, if I can come back to that sensation, whatever it is, and recognize it as impermanent, then my mind clears. But it's the coming back to that sensation that I rarely remember to do, or am so distracted that I don't do it. And so that conversation kind of brought it back for me, and I have been playing with it this week, which is interesting because it's the right concentration, mindfulness. I mean, like, that's the chapter that I read, so I guess we're going to talk about it. No, that's right. That's okay.
It's good. It's confusing.
I'm sorry. So anyway, what I was really kind of playing around with was concentration. And the first piece of the chapter on the concentration factors is, like, there's the book Buddha talking about four ways to concentrate. That really hit me in a way that I had never really read it before. And again, I was been playing around with this kind of coming back to the sensation, and I've sort of identified it as just the urge to establish myself in some way. In the next moment, in the story, and what am I gonna make for dinner, or what am I gonna, and that was profound because that urge is with me all the time. And it is often, I would call it boredom, but really it's just the urge to establish myself in this next way or whatever moment. And so I recognize how much concentration it takes to sort of just be with that urge enough to kind of let it, you know, unwind or whatever. And you know, if I've exercised and I've meditated and I've had the day off work, that's easier to do. And if I'm caught up, I'm not even thinking about it being a thing. I'm just caught up in all of it. So concentration.
Thank you.
I think I got it now.
I would say it takes quite a bit of concentration, right, to recognize that.
Yeah.
Again, that's the application. That's why we need to develop concentration,
right,
so that
right.
we can see that process. We can see how we're using, how we're attempting to continually establish a ego personality in everything that occurs, every thought that occurs, and understanding the impermanent nature underlying all things points to the fruitlessness of trying to do that. Because as soon as we can establish ourselves in a thought, the thought's gone. The self is gone. We got to keep doing it. That's the underlying stress that causes so much trouble in our lives. We're constantly trying to establish an ego personality in a permanent way that cannot take place. Lao Tzu says, once you understand the impermanence of all things, you'll let go of everything, including and most importantly, trying to establish a permanent self where it can't be. And once we fully grasp that, then we recognize, and it points to what your mom was talking about too, and you're dead. Once we recognize that, then we can truly appreciate the potential that each moment has. Each moment holds a potential to become or continue to incline our mind towards a more awakened, fully mature human being, or to ignore what we know and continue that ignorance and continue stress and suffering.
I just want to say one more thing.
Please. Please.
There is no way to talk about this except for with this.
What does that
There's
mean?
There's no way to even think about it.
Oh, yeah. You have to. Well, that's
it's
the context of the
so,
Eightfold
yeah,
Path. You need to understand that.
Yeah.
One of the reasons why the simple and direct teachings of the Buddha have gotten so far removed from what he actually taught is because of the ego personality's need to complicate nearly everything,
mm-hmm.
because that's a great distraction. But also to fit things to accommodate the truth to fit its own views. And so alterations have to be made because the Buddhist teachings teach directly contradict what the ego wants to establish.
Right.
I was talking a little bit about this Thursday night. Jiddu Krishnamurti used to say, "Look at the lives you're living." And I won't get into that story because I got quite sidetracked. Jiddu Krishnamurti was really a brilliant man who, I'm going to get into it if I'm not careful. And just take it on that. You don't need to hear his whole history unless you want to be here till tomorrow. And he gave a lot of speeches until he died in the early 60s. He's still followed by a lot of people. In fact, I still read his works. The problem with it is he does discount the importance of the Eightfold Path, but he also says that the Buddha was teaching the truth. That saying, look at the lives you're living, on the surface seems like, oh, okay, I can do that. But when you understand where it's coming from and you tie it into what the Buddha's teaching, it's the essence of the concentration factors. It's the essence of right mindfulness. Look at the lives you're living in a dispassionate way. Why? So you can recognize the things that are rooted in conceit and eye-making, rooted in trying to establish an ego personality where it can't be established, and let them go. We have to look at it. The Buddha, and probably the difference between Krishnamurti and what the Buddha realized, is we need a framework in which to recognize this. That's exactly the only reason why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path. And what you're describing and what Becky's describing is how to use the Eightfold Path to see things as the framework. Without the Eightfold Path, you would never have noticed that process going on. And your mom wouldn't either. I mean, am I making a correct statement?
That's true, yeah. Absolutely.
And that's exactly why the Buddha taught it. That's the essence of right effort and right concentration. So thank you. You both get gold stars today. Don, good morning. It's good to see you.
This is my second time through the book again, too. I've been going on Tuesdays and Saturdays, kind of mixing it up, so I'm doing what I have to do to get to as many gatherings as possible. What I've been noticing in my life more, I think, now, as far as quality of mind and how I'm applying concentration and focus and how I see it working in my life more is just how easily distracted I can become and how that distraction ties into dukkha in so many different ways. And I see that occurring all the time. And what I also see is in meditation, Shamatha Tipassana meditation, that I do get a reprieve from that a bit, but then life happens again. And I think the two words that come to mind for me right now is how I react to things opposed to how I respond to things. You know, one is an emotional internal process. The other is what I do in the world.
Yep.
That's something I've noticed about my life, and sort of as far as quality of mind goes, as far as what I'm noticing in my behaviors and my with what's going on in my mind, is I notice those types of things now. And you just mentioned that dukkha is just a part of life. It's just a part of life unfolding as it, you know,
yeah.
And it's part of my, it is the part of my life that I'm seeing that is just a part of my life. And accepting that as impermanent, along with everything else, really does help bring me to a better place. because I know that this too will not last. And then what everyone else was being shared before also about, I'm not sure who said it, but it sounded to me like constantly reinventing myself,
yeah.
Making my ego just constantly reinvent itself minute by minute by minute, all the time. And in that reinvention, that conditioned mind just gets crazier. And I notice also with the reading and with understanding this, it takes repetition for for me to understand this. So repetition is different than conditioning. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of stuff going on.
The Buddha could have nearly as accurately stated the first noble truth says that there is dukkha, or dukkha occurs in life. It simply as a consequence of having a human life. There's going to be disappointment, unsatisfactory experiences, and suffering, from minor suffering to extreme emotional and physical suffering. It's all part of just living in the world. He could as nearly accurately has said that there is distraction, because it is the distraction of trying to deal with dukkha and manage something that really can't be managed in a global way. Maybe universal is a better way of saying that. That we become so distracted and we spend our lives moment by moment trying to continually establish a self-referential ego self in every thought, word, and idea that occurs. And that is a constant struggle, and it's a constant distraction. And in that way, you could say that we really don't live our lives. We're living our lives in worship of this thing called pleasure, and in worship of this thing called aversion, which is two sides of the same coin. As we deepen concentration, we're talking about this in a very essential way this morning. As we deepen our concentration, we recognize that ongoing process of seeking to establish an ego personality, and we start diminishing it. And as we start diminishing it, our distraction lessens, our concentration increases, and peace and happiness also increases, which is what we're really after. The second noble truth states that craving originates and clinging perpetuates that distraction of dukkha. So as we can recognize the self-referential ego self requires that continued effort in order to continue itself. And as we deepen our concentration and recognize and incorporate the framework into our lives, we can simply eliminate it. There's no analysis needed. We don't have to get into the causes of why am I thinking this and why do I feel that way. It doesn't matter. If you've noticed, and Warner was talking about this a little bit last week and you reference it, if you notice aversion coming up, that's enough. You don't have to figure out anything else, like where it came from and what caused it and what happened when I was 3 years old to make me feel this way at 60. It doesn't matter. I feel this way at 60 because I feel this way at 60. It doesn't matter that, you know, my dad looked at me cross-eyed when I was 4. It doesn't matter. Everything we're experiencing in this moment is the result of our lifetimes. That's enough to know, as far as I'm talking about the Buddha's Dhamma. That's enough to know. This is what's occurring in my life. Look at the life we're living. What needs to be changed? If you can't recognize what needs to be changed, it's simply because you're lacking concentration. What's the solution? Samatha Vipassana meditation within the proper framework, and then you'll be able to see it and make those changes. So that's it. Thank you. Jay, good to see you this morning. How are you? How's your practice going?
Good morning. It's going pretty well, thank you. Meditation is rolling right along. I'm not sure if I read the right chapter, but we did study up on that long chapter on the wisdom factors. Mm-hmm. I actually remember what samadhi is, concentration, yep, which I certainly need. Impermanence also is something I've always known about, because I spent my life as an equipment operator, and there's something called entropy, which is the tendency of everything to fall apart,
yep,
and go to shit. So I've been studying, with the sludge goddess for many years, in that department, so I kind of know about that, but had some health issues, new and stranger ones in the last couple of weeks, so impermanence has been on my mind a lot. Just cope with the fact that things are going to be the way they're going to be, and we've got to adjust.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, that's the profound teaching too. Everything is always in a constant state of flux, even though we'd rather it not be, especially when we find something that makes us feel good or that we feel safe in. I want to lock into this. But everything changes. Everything changes. Thank you. Glad you're here this morning. Lisa, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Nice to see you, Dawn. Fine, thank you. That chapter, the concentration, it took a lot of concentration to get to me that chapter. It was very, very long. The chapters are getting longer and longer.
Hang on.
I kind of looked ahead because they were shorter before, and taking things a little So I felt like each, that chapter could have been divided, you know. But you use the word repetition. Actually, everything that people say, you know, it's very, you know, everything strikes me. But there's a lot of repetition in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's absolutely necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Because to get through my thick skull, all the terminology and what everything means, you know, it's just, there's so much there. And in a really long chapter, yes, there was repetition and a lot of references to previous things and future things, like, well, you'll read more about that in, you know, chapter 8 or whatever. There was just a lot there. I'm just doing the best I can getting through it. But I never realized just how many wrong ways I can do things.
But that's, yeah, that's disheartening, but it's also an important understanding.
Meditation, while meditation, because as you know, I meditate in another way. I've meditated for a long time, and I've enjoyed it. But you've mentioned this to me in the past. I read it specifically in this chapter. Is that if you know the meditation you're doing, if you're just seeking pleasure or something, is wrong.
In this context, it's
wrong. So my meditation is I lie down. It's so pleasurable and so relaxing and so wonderful in my life. It's really helped me a lot in my life, that meditation. I realized why 5 minutes of this meditation is so hard. I've meditated for, you know, 20 minutes. It comes and goes. But I'm getting a glimmer of why the 5 minutes is so hard for me. And I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what I'm thinking, right, wrong, and, you know. But, you know, it's okay for me not to know. And not to understand. Because I am where I am. But it did occur to me about, you know, it's not just the 5 minutes or 10 minutes, but taking it in
thank you. I would say you've gotten quite far. Just because of the what you're talking about and your questions point to developing that understanding. It is surprising that an adult can't sit for 5 minutes quietly and just be mindful of your breath. That should be surprising when you think about it. Also, or take that a little bit further, you've never done it before. Most of our life, from the time we're born to wherever we are in our life, is based on chasing distraction and not based on developing concentration. And I wouldn't say you're doing other things wrong, including the other meditation method that you use that you find very relaxing and helpful. I would say keep doing it. Keep doing exactly what you're doing, and also incorporate a different meditation method. You can use 40 meditation methods a day if you find it helpful. But remember that this meditation method is part of a broader framework, and incorporate that into your life. Then you might make other choices. But I wouldn't look at it as right and wrong. You know, you find something beneficial, that's fine. And you're developing this exactly as you should. Short periods of time, broadening your understanding of the Eightfold Path and slowly integrating it into your life. That's a Dhamma practice, and I think you're doing wonderfully well. as far as the book getting longer chapters and a little bit more complicated, that is by design too, though. If I started out the book with what I'll introduce this week with impermanence, not self, and dukkha, or with dependent origination, it would just be completely out of context. I doubt you'd get through the first couple pages before you say, I don't even know where this is going, because it wouldn't make any sense. But with laying the foundation for what comes later and understanding that it's part of a lifetime practice, in other words, you're not going to read the book in 10 weeks or 12 weeks and you got it. I mean, some people maybe do. But it's to introduce these teachings in a way that are most easily integrated into our lives. So we started out the first week with learning how to meditate and an introduction as to why. We need that concentration to now support the next chapter, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, that shows us or explains what should be occurring during meditation. Then we got into the Four Noble Truths, a little bit longer, a little bit more complicated, and then the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path is the last part of the Four Noble Truths, and it describes the path that we're now engaged in. And you just came through that last chapter on the Eightfold Path, deepening concentration. What you've said and what we've all talked about shows that we're deepening that concentration and developing that framework. Now we're going to get into something even a little bit more abstract, but only abstract until you can see it, and then it's very practical. So thank you for that observation. That's how it works. Thanks. Kevin, good to see you here. Is this your... No, that's not your first time here.
Here, yes.
In our class it is, but not here in the building.
Yeah, not here in the building.
Yeah.
The first time last year.
Welcome to our sangha.
I have an addiction. I think this was going very well. I had spoken to you at our Thursday night meeting a few weeks ago about how during meditation I was trying to concentrate on during meditation, I wasn't sure if that was a good thing to do. Now I think it has evolved to where I'm just doing the meditation, I'm just doing the breathing, and it really has deepened my concentration.
Yeah.
And then after I've been meditating, then I sort of do this sort of ritual that I created that goes through the Eightfold Path, so I can remind myself twice a day of what the Eightfold Path is and try to bring it more and more into my life as I approach my family and my job and everything else. I try.
Wow.
I happen to be reading about the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. I'm reading a book called The Heart of Buddhist Meditation by Jnana Panika Thera. It's like a 60-year-old book.
Yeah.
Kind of interesting, but it gets very circuitous. His language is circuitous. He's Burmese, I think.
Yeah.
So the English is interesting. It's sort of like I get lost in his language before I can actually find out what the foundations are. So I think I need to maybe switch to your book again to better clear this up for myself.
One of the problems with that, it is such another one of the basic and direct teachings that have... As it's evolved, we just made it much more complicated than we need. The Buddha taught that in a few different suttas, but primarily a sutta called the Satipatthana Sutta, which means the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And it was just meant as a simple and direct way of understanding what occurs during meditation, and really for nothing else. Even these later teachings and these later teachers, there's some benefit. I read that book and I found it useful, but I also found it exactly the same way you did. It's very circuitous, and it doesn't seem to really get to the heart of the matter. But you have to understand, he's trying to fit that basic teaching into a later developed teaching. And he came out of the Burmese Buddhist practices were changed quite radically, and they're now part of what is called the insight meditation movement. And that's quite different than from what the Buddha taught. And you can start seeing the change in that book and how he's making something that's very simple quite a bit more difficult. You know, that's just the way it is.
He referred right back to the teachings, but then I think he's trying to explain them that it gets to be circuitous.
Yeah.
But huge creative energy that I didn't have before. And I started to write, you know, I started to write a story, maybe something I've been thinking about for decades, and started to write things down after I meditated. And it's interesting, it's kind of, it's about when I was younger, but it also is so much about searching. So much about the truth, or about searching like this, searching for the truth.
Yeah. You're right about many, many people, myself included, talk about just an increase in energy as you start developing your practice. And it makes sense, because you're not wasting a lot of, as your concentration deepens, you're not wasting as much mental energy, which takes a lot of energy. So we simply have more physical energy as we deepen this practice. That what you mentioned about not thinking about the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path in your meditation and thinking about it later is just so skillful. Using meditation to deepen our concentration and not try to use it for contemplation is so important. And again, other traditions teach meditation more as a contemplative practice rather than for deepening concentration. But then to use that concentration for contemplation after meditation is so effective, because our minds are well concentrated and relaxed. It's a perfect application of it. So thank you for sharing that with our Sangha. Lorna, good to see you this morning. How are you?
You've got bullet points. You've got 8 bullet points, and a further 4, and one thing. If you just read one of those bullet points and really understand what it's asking you to do, and then further read into the chapter of Round Effort, Round Mindfulness, and you try to absorb and be mindful of what you're asking us to be mindful of, it became overwhelming for me. It's just more than, I think it's more than I can do. I think it's more than, and I got very disheartened, you could say, and all sorts of stuff like that. And I think to the right effort and right mindfulness to hold all of that in mind and to pull that off in life, I just think it's an overwhelming amount of concentration to do that. And I the more I kind of read and understood, the more overwhelmed I got. The more disappointing and the more and then you mentioned the sixth sense base as well, which is a whole raft of emotions that we're trying to disconnect from, you know, recognize what feelings are coming through from our sixth sense base and trying to disconnect so they don't mean so much, and all that work as well. I got really disillusioned, and I know we've said this is not an easy practice to take, but sometimes I had a bad time with it. I never got around to reading right meditation. I couldn't start it. I don't know. It was so it's just so much work.
So it can seem obviously, it can seem overwhelming at times. What's most important is to recognize that what is experiencing that disappointment, and what is experiencing that feeling of being overwhelmed, and then tying it back into the first noble truth, dukkha occurs. Even in our Dhamma practice, that's true. That's a noble truth, and we're going to experience it. So what do we do when we're feeling that? The most important thing is to be gentle with yourself and understand that you don't have to get it the first time through the chapter or the tenth time through the chapter. Right effort also shows us that it is in consistent, the word is kshanti, patient forbearance, consistent practice that develops understanding. So even though going through the chapter this time seemed overwhelming, what do? Come back to the practice and understand that it's a gradual process. We don't have to get it all at once. You know, it's not... an understanding of... And the book gets into the Ratana Sutta at the end. It's an added chapter at the end of the book. Taking refuge in the idea that a human being did exactly this. He left his teachings, the Dhamma, so that we can do the same thing and that we're not doing it alone. We have the support of a Sangha to do it too. And that can help alleviate some of that, those feelings of being overwhelmed. We can only do what we can do. But we can do it. You know, and you know yourself that you've made tremendous progress in this over the last couple of years and great understandings. Next week you may say something completely different, like, wow, I looked at it again. I'm not predicting something. But your view of how this works changes moment by moment, too. That's part of impermanence, and I'll talk about that in just a few minutes. But thank you for bringing that up. Brett, good to see you. How have you been?
Good. Good to be here meditating twice a day and not doing the course, but it's nice to come and hear all this stuff. A lot of key things that I miss that I don't get from meditating by myself.
You got to come here.
Thanks for being here.
I'm glad you're here. Tom, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good. I'm going to stop sitting in a seat by the time you stop meditating and I hear everyone, whatever I had wanted to say is completely changed, or maybe I forget what I want to say. So it's impermanent.
Yeah, it is.
But it is interesting sitting in this seat because, you know, I had some things I want to say. Everyone that had it really did change what I was thinking about, wanted to talk about. And so prior to coming to your classes, I had, you have a preconceived notion of what meditation is.
Yep.
And I've always been the type, I'm an overthinker, I overthink everything, my mind is going, there's a lot going on in my head. And you know, from the first class that I came to, I was amazed at how my understanding, how easy of it, how it was. Maybe I'm misunderstanding, and every day I learn something new, and every class I learn something new, but the only thing that I'm trying to do is not have a thought, follow a thought, and that's the only thing I think of when I meditate, is don't have a thought, follow a thought, go back to your breathing as soon as you get caught up in that thought. Mm-hmm. And I just focus on that, and that's it, you know, not trying to think about the Eightfold Path or anything else in a very pure form that really helps me with everything. You know, it flows into everything I do in my life. And so when I read about right meditation, when I get to that part of the chapter, you know, that's really what I was thinking. It's just don't have a thought, follow a thought. And then when I talk about, right effort, you know, last week I didn't actually do the reading because I was just hadn't come to class and hadn't putting in the right effort. I was meditating here and there, but the last 2 weeks I've been meditating, you know, twice a day. And, you know, they haven't been very concentrated meditations. You know, it might be, you know, if I do a 5-minute meditation, it might have been 4 minutes, 55 seconds of thoughts following thoughts, and that last 5 seconds I'm like, oh, breathe. You know, and then other times it's 4 minutes and 30 seconds, you know, and so it just depends on what's going on. And yeah, for me, that is a successful meditation.
It is.
It's 55 seconds of, you know. But, you know, when I put in the right effort and when I read this week, and, you know, it's amazing because, you know, I know Lorna said she had a hard time with, you know, the reading, and you're talking about how, you know, difficult it's been for you. And I've, you know, we do overcomplicate things in life. And you know, you were talking about thinking about everything from going back to your 3 years old and what happened. And I've been going, you know, my whole life has been just this journey of figuring out what the heck went wrong with me.
Yeah.
and then very much recently, you know, and now I'm kind of finding that I'm on the right path, and certainly coming to your classes has put me on the right path in a lot of ways. And, you know, it's true. You know, I've really had a hard time with not trying to figure out every little detail that happened for the 42 years I've been on this earth and why I got to the place I'm at now. And I have a hard time with that because I feel like I'm a thinker and I need to figure it out because this is going to happen again. I can prepare because what's going to happen here? And when you start thinking that way, you drive yourself nuts. And really, it is simple. Is that we make life so hard, and it doesn't have to be hard. And it's that stress that we put on ourselves that doesn't need to be there. And so coming to your class, it came very, you know, obvious to me about a lot of these things. And it just, you know, it starts, I've had that compassion too. And I think that's really kind of what, you know, those are the things I focused on. You know, just not following the thought with a thought, having compassion with myself, and then putting in that right effort of reading about the Eightfold Path. But I haven't tried to read it too quickly or too slowly. I probably didn't, you know, verbalize a lot of stuff I read, but my intention of all this is it's not going to be, you know, I come to the class for a year and we go through it, I'm done. Like, this is the rest of my life. I want to do it. And when I look, read it, and it is that repetition that we talked about, but when I read it, we could read the same words over and over and over, but every time I read it, that impermanent not self that we talk about is seeing it with a different colored light. So now I'm not just reading the words and saying, oh yeah, that makes sense, but now I'm saying, wait a minute, it makes sense from this perspective and this perspective. I mean, getting a full perspective of, you know, what that actually is when you read it each time. So I'm trying to keep it simple and that not follow up with the thought. I'm doing the reading. If I don't understand it, that's fine. I'm going to read it again. And so I appreciate how you've done the class and how you've done the book. And I'm trying to keep it simple because when I don't keep it simple, I'm going to drive myself nuts. And that's a very good way for me to not practice anymore because I will derail what I want to do. So I think that's kind of where I'm at. And, you know, I'm going to continue trying to put in the right effort with the readings. And, you know, that the meditation time for me is the time that I carve out. I'm trying to look at it as a time, whether it's 5 minutes or a half hour, where I don't judge myself, I don't judge my thoughts, I don't have those emotions. It's that time that those thoughts can come by, and they're just thoughts. It doesn't matter, because that's my time to, you know, not let the world beat me up, and me beat me up. So I think that's kind of where I'm at.
Thank you. I mean, it's such a good reminder when we meditate that this is a time to meditate, period. It's not for solving problems, it's not for doing anything, but just meditating to remind ourselves to not follow a thought with a thought. That's how we deepen our concentration. And it's so important to avoid the tendency to want to figure everything out, meaning to get to a root cause of what happened. How did I get here? The root cause of all human problems is what the Buddha awakened to, ignorance, and a very specific ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And when we can develop an understanding and use that as a framework for our life, analysis just falls away. We don't have to figure anything out because it's right in front of us. Here it is. This is dukkha. It's not something that I can avoid. But what I can do is to avoid contributing to additional suffering and confusion and distraction in my life by gaining control of my thinking, and by gaining a realistic view of how life is, as opposed to spending your whole life trying to chase what's going to make you feel good and avoid anything that might bring disappointment into your life. It's going to occur. We're going to have things that make us feel good. We're going to have things that make us feel not so good. both of them are just part of life. They're not something that we should create identities over or insist that they be any different than it is. So thank you for saying that. A great class. Yes?
I have a quick question about changing the meditation from 20 minutes to 30 minutes. And what that, you know, why did that or what that comes from? You know, you changed the time with that also. I don't know about this, like, 20 minutes. This is what, you know, what you're working up to. So I just wondered about the 30 minutes because it's a long time.
Thank you for asking, and I meant to ask, how was that for everyone? It was
okay for me.
I
kind
of went really fast.
I did too, but I was very distracted. I mean, I was really up in a whole fantasy world.
I was drinking coffee. I could smell coffee.
Well, okay, so I'll answer the question because I wanted to. No,
but I'm done.
A few years ago, maybe 3 or 4 years ago now, there was some Zen meditation practitioners, and Zen meditation is basically just sitting. It's not to say they don't ever consider other things, but it's basically just sitting, and it's basically sitting for long, long periods of time. And so this small group of folks asked me if I would start just a meditation session here with no callbacks, no instructions. They just wanted to come and sit. And I said, okay, so we'll do that. So I started doing it before our regular Saturday class. Very quickly, they stopped coming anyway, but I continued with it. And one of the reasons why I changed it is because, frankly, I'm spreading myself a little thin right now. But also I felt it was a little redundant because we don't do Zen meditation here. We do meditation within a broader framework, and I think it's important to have a class and a discussion attached with our meditation practice. The reason why from 20 to 30 minutes, I think that our Sangha can support the longer sit, and also those that don't regularly meditate for 30 minutes, it's just a good idea for once in a while to stretch yourself out and realize that, yeah, you can sit for 30 minutes. It doesn't kill you. Although it may be uncomfortable, and that's why I also say, if you're using the method and it seems that it's just too uncomfortable, stop and just sit quietly and then pick up the method again, you know. Meditation practice itself should not be another aspect of dukkha. In other words, this is just so hard I can't stand it. On our own, 5, 10, 15 minutes is usually enough, especially when we begin our practice. But usually the group can support each other in sitting for longer periods of time. So that's why I do it. And I'm thinking I might change the Tuesday night class to 30 minutes too, but we'll see. So now that you said that, how was that for you? How was the 30 minutes?
Well, I have a hard time just because of physical, you know, issues I have of sitting in one place. And when I move, I can go back to the meditation.
Yeah.
But it's a little bit harder to sit in one place.
It's something else. It's okay to move when you know, we shouldn't be so rigid that I can't. I mean, I used to meditate in the Zen tradition, and you took the form that they told you, and if you moved a muscle, it sounds awful, but it's agreed upon. They use a stick called a kayasaka. It's a stick with two that split at the end, and they whack you on your back. And that's a reminder that you might have hunched over. They might think you're falling asleep. Again, you agreed that this is what they're going to do. It's not that you're being attacked. But the point is that your form, and it's even taught, your form is much more important than what's actually going on between your ears. And, of course, that's silly. Sitting a certain way is not going to deliver awakening to me.
It can be distracting.
It was to me. And I would do it for hours and hours and hours. I mean, I did a lot of sesshins that way, which are 7 to 10 day events where you're meditating for 14 to 16 hours a day, and you look around a room and people are just, they're drenched in sweat and they're crying and they're shaking trying to hold this form.
Oh my God.
And I'm not trying to put down that whole tradition. And there's many people that can do it gracefully and they get, the point is it was just brutal. And every time I did those long sesshins, the best thing about them is that they came to an end. And honestly, I don't know that I ever got anything out of them. And I talked to some other people, and they said the same way. I'm glad this is over. So I found that that's not a meditation method for me. What I found, and when I started reading how the Buddha taught meditation, for one thing, he never put a length of time on it. In other words, he never said, boy, you got to meditate for 3 hours every day. He said, go find the root of a tree or an empty hut and engage in this meditation method. And understanding the gentleness of this man, I would say that he would probably say the same thing that I do. Of course, I'm speculating. Start with short periods of time. Be very gentle with yourself and then gradually add time. That leads to what I was going to say. If you have to move in meditation, move. Stretch your legs. Do what you need to do to be comfortable. Just remember that the quieter our bodies are during meditation, our minds will tend to follow that. So we don't want to be fidgeting around all the time. But even in that, there's a middle way. If you're uncomfortable, if your joints are aching, move. You could even stretch and come back to your posture and pick up your meditation. You know, and there's nothing that says that if you decide you're going to meditate for 5 minutes or a half an hour, that you cannot move, you can't come out of the meditation method or anything. Again, if you have to come out of it for a few moments, it's your meditation. What's most important is to understand why you're there. You're there to deepen concentration. So if you're distracted by an achy knee, you can't deepen your concentration. Move a little bit. And there's nobody here that's going to hit you with a stick if you do so. Okay, a great question. Any other questions about what we've talked about so far? It's gotten a little late, but I'll introduce this. I see Brett's ready to go right through the ceiling, but if you have to leave, it's okay.
Yeah, I have a job.
I understand. Good to see you, Brett. I hope to see you soon. So this week's study is on the three marks of existence. I'm just going to put this in the context of the Four Noble Truths and let you read it. The first noble truth states that dukkha occurs. Dukkha occurs because of individual craving for a certain existence and clinging to that existence once it's established. This directly relates to the three marks of existence of impermanence, anicca, anatta, the not-self-characteristic, and the resulting dukkha. It's because we have established a self that we hope to be permanent in an environment that is completely impermanent that we create suffering in our lives. Everybody gets that? Dukkha occurs because of the interaction of an ignorant understanding of what constitutes a self, in this impermanent environment. We cannot change impermanence. It's part of living in the human world. When the Buddha described suffering, he described it this way. Birth is suffering, aging is suffering, sickness is suffering, death is suffering. All aspects of impermanence, aren't they? Even sickness is an aspect of impermanence. We get sick, we get better, hopefully. Birth is an ongoing process in impermanence. Just ask my mom. Then he went on to say, not getting what is desired is suffering. Part of life. That's also part of impermanence. We get things that we want, but because of impermanence, for one reason or another, they're no longer with us. Not getting what is desired is suffering. Getting what is hoped to be avoided, aversion, is also suffering. Part of life. It's part of the impermanent nature. We got everything settled. My life is just perfect. And then that aunt calls and reminds us of something. Or a friend calls. Or the boss calls. We're no longer perfect anymore. Our life is upset. Part of impermanence. Everything's changing. We cannot create an environment where there will not be any disappointment. We cannot create an environment where all of our sensual needs are always fulfilled. Yet we tend to try, don't we? Then the Buddha finished that saying by saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are suffering. I won't get into that talk because that's 2 weeks from now. But what that refers to, the five clinging aggregates, are clinging to views that establish a self. All part of that not-self characteristic. So the three marks of existence are what we're here to gain insight to. That second aspect of shamatha vipassana. We first quiet our mind so that we gain insight. What is that insight? It's insight into the impermanent nature of all things and the interaction between the not-self characteristic, a misunderstanding of self, and that impermanence. You were talking about that pretty skillfully, Tom. We recognize the impermanence of our thoughts. And in that, we recognize the impermanence of the foolishness of trying to establish a permanent self within an impermanent environment. It simply can't be done. Look at the life we're living. I'll use Jiddu Krishnamurti and Lao Tzu to make the point. I said both of them before. Look at the life you're living. Once you recognize the impermanence of all things, you'll let go of everything. The essence of the Buddha's teaching when he's describing suffering. Let go of the need for anything to be permanent, especially the views that you're holding of yourself. Because once you can fully grasp that, there's that old song from the Funkadelics, free your mind and your will follow. Once you recognize that, you have now freed your mind to continue towards going toward, to awake towards awakening in this present moment. Stop holding on to fixed views. Recognize that even your views are impermanent. And continue to develop that understanding of the three marks of existence. So, right on time. As you read this chapter on the three marks of existence, it is a rather long article. But try to remember that it is taught not as a standalone teaching. It's taught as in the context of the Four Noble Truths to developing understanding of the First Noble Truth. That's the talk for today. That's enough. Any questions about that or what we're going to be studying this week? Okay, let's finish with the Buddha's words on metta. Just an announcement. I think you all caught it. I announced in a newsletter that our retreat, the reservations are up, and all the information is on the website too. So, hope you can join us. So, find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body, and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talk today. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart can one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.